It is Saturday, November 24th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the Week in Geek News, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're doing the Week in Geek News, and in the second half, I'll welcome you to join our conversations. You can ask us anything you like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or, of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and send us email. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. Welcome to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, Slacker Geek and Student.
Good morning.
You're wearing a cowboy hat. Why are you wearing a cowboy hat
that you gave to me? Yeah, it's just love, man.
Okay, good, good. Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning, Lyle.
You're not wearing a cowboy hat.
I'm not.
But you finally have your goatee back in fine shape.
Yeah, it's coming.
That's good. Yeah. Mistaken shaving.
Yeah.
And Ben Jaffe, student at UCSC and assistant to the technical coordinator at Digital Arts and New Media MFA program. Hi, Ben.
Morning.
So we're going to do some geek news, I think would be applicable for today. Miles, I'll start with you, since you're so smartly dressed.
The California Secretary of State's office has sued the e-voting vendor ES&S over changes in their electronic voting machine. Apparently, the company had sold exactly 972 ballot machines to five California counties. And contrary to the rules for the election process, they made changes to those devices before after they had been certified.
After the review.
Mm-hmm. And they're relatively minor changes, but at the same time, it's one of those things. It's elections, and it's also electronic voting machines, which has been a major issue and a recurring topic on this show.
Sure.
And so they're being sued to the amount of $10,000 per device.
Oh, nice. So some real money. Who's suing them specifically?
The state of California through the California Secretary of State's office.
Interesting. How many devices do they have in production? Do you know?
In production?
If it's 10,000 per device.
That California bought, yeah. 972.
Wow. That's some serious money.
Over five California counties.
That's great. I mean, I think. So do you think that California's going to win this case pretty hands down?
I don't think they'll get 10,000 per.
Right.
I think that's more of like an upper limit. I think it's kind of up in the air. It depends on how angry people get.
Yeah. I have a feeling with elections coming up that we're going to cover more and more of these kind of problems with electronic voting machines, as we seem to do every...
Or just problems with voting in general.
That's
but
true.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for keeping us abreast on that. What's your current feeling on electronic voting? Like, if you went into the polls today and you saw an electronic voting machine, would you participate in it or not?
It's not the electronic voting machine as a concept that I have a problem with. It's the current implementation of those voting machines that I have a problem
with. Have you seen anything good coming out of electronic voting implementation?
Yes, I have seen some implementations that do have a paper record that they print out.
And are any of those going to be in production in California?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I actually don't know.
Yeah.
In the Santa Cruz area, people have been pretty resistant to it, and you mostly see the Scantron style,
yeah.
Which ironically is not more secure. people talk about like, oh, well, I just want to use a pen and paper and that'll be okay. But if you have, for example, a Scanstrom machine, it's still a machine, an optical scanner that's reading these ballots.
Right.
And if someone goes in and changes the number so that I've seen demonstrations of this where the actual machine that tallies it is electronic.
Yeah.
Even if the voting machine itself.
Granted, but you do have a paper trail. As abstract as that paper is.
Right. Presuming that you actually have a recount.
Right. All right. Thank you very much, Miles. We will keep you abreast on the... Miles is very good about keeping up on the electronic voting and voting in general. Thank you for being such
a... Or harping, you know, beating a dead horse.
Yeah. That's true. Ben, should I go to you since you are in the row?
Sure. So there is a new method that's being reported for authenticating devices with each other. So if you're in a spontaneous interaction environment, like on a bus or, you know, really most interaction environments where you're not wired, you can authenticate, say, cell phones or mobile devices, Palm Pilots, with each other by shaking them together, just by taking one of them and then taking the other one in your hand and then shaking them, as opposed to trying to find a way to, you know, mess with numbers and addresses and, you know, wirelessly communicate. So it's a...
Is this just...
first off, spontaneous interaction environment? Is that a new...
I was... Now, that actually, I was quoting from the PDF that I found online that explained... The paper that they released that explains this.
Okay.
Sorry. Spontaneous interaction in ubiquitous computing environments.
Why does the shake... What's the... Why is the shaking important?
Why is the shit
natural?
It's
instinctive, you know, like, assuming you have some degree of coordination.
Yeah, so, but now I have a question. Mm. If you're on a bus and you have two people sitting next to each other with these devices and you go over a bump, they're both shaking at the same time.
Yeah,
but not
for a couple seconds straight. So,
have you been on Santa Cruz Road?
Okay, so instead of the Bluetooth thing where you say, start looking for device. Hey, I hear a device. Oh, let's talk to a device. Okay, now give a number, and now let's enter a number in both devices. Oh, yay, they're talking. Instead, you just grab them, put them together in one hand, in two hands together so you don't drop them, mm-hmm. and shake them. So that basically the frequency of the shake is completely matched, so some kind of number is being generated from a gyroscope inside them, and those numbers happen to match because it happened at the same time. And, Miles, your concern is that
if you have
a bus would shake it just the same.
Yeah, you have two devices that are next to each other, like, for example, in two purses next to one another, and then you hit the bump, they're both going to be bouncing at about the same rate. Well,
presumably, they both have to be seeking each other at the
same time. It sounds
like
a wonderful way for electronics to get together.
Well, I guess that's the issue. Is do you have to hit a button ahead of time to say, I want to sync with someone else, and you have to hit on the other one saying,
probably.
I want to receive.
I mean, this is the equivalent of basically, you know, putting in the four-digit passcode or whatever for Bluetooth pairing.
To me, you know, when you think about accident proneness qualities of life, the idea of let's take expensive device and put them together and shake them vigorously, just eventually someone's going to drop one or both of them. So hey, let's sync up. Okay, who wants to shake? I'll do it, my hands are sticky. And then they do it versus the butterfingers person who throws the phone across the room. Okay, well, thank you very much for this. It's interesting you bring up gyroscope. It kind of affects the one of the projects I'm working at work is playing with the Nike Plus iPod, which is a little device you put in your shoe and you plug the other side into your iPod, and it's basically a pedometer. And one of the interesting things about this little transmitting device is that there's a weight on a condenser microphone, and as the weight gets wiggled, it actually produces enough electricity to transmit to the receiver. In any case, each one of these has a unique ID, and of course you get a rate of shake that would be very equivalent to the information they're trying to get by shaking two devices.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There's more accuracy, though, in the two devices because they'll have built-in accelerometers as opposed to, like, the Nike things. They only know if they're moving or if they're stopped.
Right.
And so,
or when they change angle.
Yeah.
So these are actually going to be these are going to actually be gyroscopic devices inside there?
Yeah, they'll be a little three-axis accelerometers.
Okay, that's so cool, because then you can start using them as a Wii remote.
Yeah, oh, God.
Thank you very much, Ben, for that. Ryder, you're up next, man.
So, interesting benchmarks came out on Windows XP Service Pack 3 that's due to be released soon. It's currently a release candidate.
I thought that they released Vista and then Windows XP is dead.
Oh, no, 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 no.
Quite the opposite.
No.
They released Vista and they went, is Windows XP still around? Yes, it is. Yeah. Oh, good.
No, it seems to have had a resurgence since Vista came out, I would think.
Yeah, I think that's true. Okay, so Windows Service Pack 3, we heard that they're releasing
this. It's just a little factoid, but they're finding that there's a 10% performance boost when you install Service Pack 3 over Service Pack 2, which is fabulous. I mean,
10%.
When you consider that Vista is almost twice as slow in XP in some regards to performance.
Is there some kind of internal battle at Microsoft where the XP people, they're going, we can make it better?
You know, when you build something from the ground up, sometimes you don't build it right. You know?
Or when you're building from the ground up, the first thing you do is try to make sure that it works, and then you optimize it for speed. So, yeah, they're having some...
There's also a Service Pack 1 for Vista that's going to be coming out, and so far it's a performance dud. So, I mean, it's kind of...
I am curious about, has anybody seen any security reports on Vista and its comparison to XP?
I believe it is better. I mean, I think it's one redeeming quality is that, you know, there are a lot...
It's more secure.
That's a really big redeeming quality, especially for internet-connected computers.
It is, but,
especially
for Windows machines.
It depends. It really depends on what your priorities are. I mean, sure, security should be important in everyone's mind, but... If you're not on the network and you're just a gamer, you know, and you know,
well, wait, but gamers are on the network. Like,
not
who's
always. I don't game online.
That's do you connect
cool
to the
right
internet
now?
Through your computer?
Well, I don't do networking games, but yeah, I mean,
that's the thing. Though.
There are some people that do not connect to the internet and do.
What you're saying, Miles, is safety is the most important thing, not liberty.
Not liberty.
Well, I'm saying, you know.
Well, you know, speed of performance.
I would say
is
security is more important than outright speed.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with security.
As long as you can actually use the system, even if it's not as fast.
But what Ryder's saying is, you know, he uses a home router with a firewall, and he's relatively safe about what he's using. He's using an email client, maybe even a web email client. He's got some safety protocols built into how he runs his life, which makes his machine not infected. And so running XP with a performance boost over Vista, even if Vista's more secure, it's not really going to affect him because he's taking care of the security aspect. Is that good synopsis?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Also, I haven't bought Vista.
Can I make some notes on that?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Make some changes.
Okay. Ben,
oh,
you guys
I was just going to say that. Also, there's some gray area as to whether or not it's actually more secure because Vista has the user account control thing, which, you know, someone's trying to access your machine, accept or deny constantly. And if it gets so annoying that people just decide to blindly click accept, which, you know, very often happens, or even just disable it entirely, then there goes your security feature. Mm. And all of a sudden,
I'm not familiar with this feature. Could you?
Oh, come on.
I don't have Vista at home.
I'm going to get the Apple commercial. It's the best thing.
Yeah.
You know what? In a little bit, Miles, we'll have to play the Apple ad for on air. We'll do it.
It's basically a feature that any sort of secure level interaction, installing applications, updating drivers, seemingly anything. I mean, it pops up all the time. If you have something that needs to access ports, does it do it with that as well?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Well, anytime you install an application.
Anything or a privileged port. I mean,
it's basically a pop-up dialogue from the operating system that says, hey, this is trying to do this. Do you want to accept
it or
deny?
So they have a default deny system that you have to always
enable. No, it's a default ask. It asks. And there's an accept button and there's a deny button.
But that's the thing. It's a default deny that if you're not allowed to do it, it will have to prompt you. It won't just allow you to do it unless it's on a blacklist.
No, it's more like even if the user account that currently is active has the permission to do this,
it's still a dialogue. Even if you're
so
the administrator.
So if you're running, it's still running as
No, I understand what you're saying. And it's called a default deny setup.
Okay.
Technically, it is more secure. It's also a lot more inconvenient.
I don't think it's more secure.
Well, it takes the foreground, and you can't background it. You have grays your screen.
It gives the user the choice every time, but they don't have to put a password in. The operating system already has the rights to do it. It's just querying the user if they want to do it.
Right.
So that's not really a default deny. Default deny would be... I guess you're right. It is a default deny.
It's unlike XP, where everything is allowed unless you put in some software to block items.
Yes, I guess. Yeah.
But it relies on user patience.
Yeah, and you have to read every single one of these dialogues or you're going to start accepting everything. And pretty soon, a virus is going to come up and say, hey, this virus wants to erase your operating system. And it'll be like, you want to accept or deny? Accept. You know, I mean, it's just not a very good
design. And on follow-up, Ben brought up a point that he saw a survey that indicated that only 10% of IT professionals plan on upgrading to Vista as well.
When? in the near any, term.
In the,
only 10%.
In like
all right, let's
next,
do a little. In the next 6 months, anybody here planning on upgrading to Vista?
Oh, no.
Miles? You haven't even turned on your Windows machine since you moved, huh?
No, I have because I have to use it for Netflix video. They don't have a Mac version for that, but not on a regular basis. Not.
Are you planning on upgrading to Vista?
I don't have a particular reason to buy it.
I guess so. I'm planning on upgrading to Vista when I cannot play the newest games on XP, and that's when I'll go to Vista. And right now you can play
everything. I guess
on.
I wouldn't have that same benchmark because I have Sean as a friend.
Right, right.
So Sean. I'll end up with a new machine with
Sean
on it.
Here, Sean's, by the way, sick. Why he's not here today. Let's go on to the next news story. I think we're down to... Yeah, right. Go ahead.
No, I just went.
You just went. Yeah, that's right. It's Miles.
This one is a bit troubling for me on the security... Speaking of security, Hushmail is a company that keeps PGP keys for secure email. You
What's
use them
PGP?
PGP stands for Pretty Good Privacy. What they're doing is acting as a escrow source, or key escrow. You go to them, they give you a key pair, private key, public key, and you are able to encrypt your email and then have it certified that, yes, this email is coming from this particular person. And they're useful because if you lose your key, then it's hard to tell people, okay, expire that old key, here's a new one. They take care of all of that. They take out a lot of the complexity there.
And it's called Hushmail?
Hushmail, yes. However, it's been found that Hushmail has been providing the email key, the PGP keys to the government, turning over private keys of users on
come
request.
Come on, you're kidding me.
So that all that encrypted email can be decrypted. And that was not made clear to Hushmail's clients, the people who were paying for the service. So you end up with this issue now of people were thinking, I have this secure communication.
Isn't the whole point that you are completely private? You just completely decide. It's like having a private conversation in your own home. But okay, so there's a whole background about this. The idea of that, can the government search your mail? Because the mail system, especially in the U.S., postage is run by the government. Theoretically, they could open every message and look through it and close it again and seal it and send it on, and that's basically very illegal, right? Without a search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
But with email, the servers where the content goes through, it's very easy to, in some degrees technically, to have a sniffing machine installed in multiple network nodes and actually get traffic. So Pretty Good Privacy, this idea is I'm going to encrypt something with this really strong security model, and then only Miles can open this message and unencrypt it.
Right. Not only I can open it, but I can cryptographically guarantee that you're the one who wrote it.
Right. There's
two
things. You can sign it and you can also encrypt it. So the signature I'm not so concerned about. But in any case, the idea is that with your private key, your very top secret, you're the only one that has control over it. You would send a message to me, or I would give you a public version of mine, and you would give me a public version of yours, and we could encrypt stuff that only each other could open, or we could sign stuff that we could verify.
Right, because we don't share our private key.
We only share
our public key.
So now this is like an unopenable envelope. It goes to the postal service. So if the government gets a copy of this thing, it's a scrambled mess. They can't read it without our secret key. And you're saying that one of the major providers that makes this whole system simpler, Hushmail, has been giving these keys to the government so that they can open messages.
Yes, as part of an investigation, yes.
And I would assume that the idea would be that they'd only do this in the event of a search order, or do the same rules of mail do not apply in this situation?
The same rules as postal mail absolutely do not apply with email, at least not at this point. It is not treated with the same care.
Sad.
It's currently a reality, so... How we deal with this, how we react to it, I guess, is really where this goes. And if you ask how many companies are going to be doing something like that, you have to think of companies like AT&T and Verizon who have given information to the government without public knowledge. You know, I'm thinking it's going to become more common, not less common, unless people actually stand up and say, whoa, whoa, this is not acceptable.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for that. Ben, do you have another news story? Or Ryder? Ben, you got one?
I have kind of a silly one. It was last week I found this delightful application called MacSaber 1.1, And basically, it uses a sudden motion sensor in your computer to let you swing it around, which is, seems like a bad idea inherently, but it'll make lightsaber effects and it'll flash your screen
I
and your backlit
keyboard. Yeah, you showed me this recently.
Yeah,
it's dangerous thing in the world.
It's the stupidest thing in the world to do, but...
But you downloaded it anyway.
Yeah, of course. I downloaded it anyway. I played with it for 5 minutes and almost bricked my laptop and deleted it and vowed never to download it again.
Yeah, you're not supposed to clash with other MacBooks. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No clashing with the other MacBooks.
All right, Miles, we're going to go ahead and play the Apple. I'm probably going to break copyright infringement, all that stuff. Who cares? So we're going to play the Apple ad that talks about the Vista thing. First off, let's see if I can actually... Ooh, we hear it.
Hello, I'm a Mac. Mac has issued a salutation, cancel or allow?
Allow, and I'm a PC.
You're a returning Mac salutation, cancel or allow?
Allow.
Okay, what gives? Mac is asking a question, cancel or allow?
Allow. He's part of Vista, my new operating system. PCs have a lot of security problems, so he asked me to authorize pretty much anything I do.
You're pointing out Vista's flaws, cancel or allow?
Allow. I could turn him off, but then he wouldn't give me any warnings at all, and that would defeat the purpose, so...
You are coming to a sad realization, cancel or allow?
Allow.
So that's the ad we're talking about Vista's. Yeah. Okay. I think that's the first time we've done that. I think maybe
that's
inspired.
An effective ad.
It's an effective ad, isn't it? Yeah. Any case. Okay. We're not doing Vista yet. That's good. I guess that we have no input on that. Of course, Sean is using Vista very effectively. He loves it, I think, and he knows a lot more about Windows than any of us do, probably combined. He's sick, unfortunately. Sad thing. Coming to a sad realization in life. One more news story?
Sure. This one's pretty geeky. And I kind of disagree with the results. But
you're going to say
there was a user poll on the top 50 fictional best weapons. Basically being sourced from literature, comic books, movies, etc. And so I'm not going to give you all 50, of course, but the top five were, number five was the Star Trek phaser. Number four was Star Wars lightsaber. Of course, it has to be in the top five.
Not if it's built into a laptop?
Not if it's built into a laptop. It has right. to be, you know, Darth Vader, you know, Luke Skywalker. They got to be wielding that puppy. Number three, Iron Man's armor from Marvel Comics. Number two, and this is the one I really disagree with, He-Man's power sword from the cartoon He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. That's just wrong.
It tells a lot about who actually responded to this query, though.
I don't know. I'd say that the lightsaber was pretty wrong. Give me a good blaster any day.
Yeah. And number one, you know, this is diehard
assuming
comic,
you're not
comic
fighting
fans.
A Jedi.
Number one is the Green Lantern's power ring from DC Comics.
Okay, that's got to be number one.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's
pretty cool.
And, you know, there were a lot of them in the top 50 that, you know, I thought were way better.
I think that's the geekiest thing that's ever been on
That's
Geek
pretty
Speak.
Geeky. Yeah.
Thank you very much. You win the prize. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. And actually, Henry J. Ramirez is a friend of the show, and my dentist, we're actually going to have him on right before some surgery that I'm about to have that he's going to be performing. So we might actually do a live feed from the air room of me screaming, or if the dentistry. But that's going to be later, I guess, this month. Yeah,
yeah, you screaming on air for Dr. Maris would not be a good ad.
That's not good radio?
No.
Okay. Actually, I don't think I've ever screamed for
him. No, you know, I used to have him as my dentist. He's a great dentist.
Yeah,
I had root canal, not feel a thing. It was awesome.
Cool. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology on GeekSpeak. You can call us with anything you'd like. We'll answer any questions you have. We're good with Linux and Windows and Macintosh OS. And if you want to know about electricity and how it works or a little bit about chemistry, we might be able to handle that. We got another couple of news stories we're going to be talking about too. But we are taking your calls right now. Rick Filman's waiting in the room. And all you have to do is call. And therefore, all I have to do is give you the phone numbers. And they are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. You can, of course, send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org. Stay tuned today for a very special Castle Cottage. I'm going to be hosting some of the geek menagerie. Oh, that just sounded bad. My wife, Sean's wife, That's Daria and Maggie are going to be in doing some great kids programming on Castle Cottage. So the kids program today is going to be done by the Geeks, and that's in about half an hour. So if you know some family friends that avoid Geek Speak horribly, make sure to call them up and let them know in half an hour they should let their kids listen to KOSP, because it'll be a kids show and it should be a fun thing to do. Let's see. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Ryder Brooks. We're taking calls with questions and comments of technology from you. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. Well, we got calls right away, but why don't you tell me about the neat material that they've just made? I know we weren't going to really cover this because we don't know enough about it, but it's just too cool not to talk about.
So there, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, there's a material called metamaterials that are basically artificially produced material that are designed for a purpose. And basically the effect of the metamaterial is determined by its composition rather than how it's shaped and whatnot. So device or material that was produced by a Princeton-led research team, University of Princeton, I believe. They built it's made out of silicon or something out of computer chip type material that basically they've designed it to build it so that light will bend the wrong way. So you'll get like a negative light refraction
Index of refraction, right?
Yeah, and so kind of hard to explain. I don't fully understand it, but one of the results that they thought that would be applicable to this material that I thought was fascinating is that you could make glasses. People have really bad vision. Typically, they have to bend the light using curvature of the lens, which in the process of correcting your vision, if you have astigmatism or near farsightedness, it can distort your vision in the process, your depth of perception.
Right, the way you traditionally do lenses is you make a piece of glass that has a very stable index of refraction. It has only one type of index. Mm-hmm. And you then curve the glass, and the interface with the air and the glass causes the bend of light that produces a magnifying effect or a lensing effect. Mm-hmm. And so the idea with something like this, of having a material that has a negative index of refraction, is that you'd be able to put this material with something like glass, and in that merge effect you could produce a lens that had no geometric differences. Both sides are parallel and yet was still causing magnification. Kind of like the effect, the pseudo effect that a Fresnel lens would do if you put it in those little pieces of cardboard or flat card that you have a lensing effect, but there's lines in them and they're flat. Kind of like that, but there'd be no lines. It's really cool. It's a great thing.
So the end result is you have what appears to be a regular sheet of glass that you use as your lenses. There's no distortion of your vision in terms of depth of perception. I mean, personally, I'm very susceptible to this. I should wear glasses, but I don't because I get motion sickness really bad because of that change of depth and distortion. And so this basically would just be like wearing a sheet of glass over your eyes that has no effect other than correcting your vision. So it would be awesome.
Thank you, Ryder, for that update on new materials. It's a very exciting field. From Santa Cruz, we have Heidi. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. Thank you. I'm interested in your recommendations for free email services.
Why do you want free email?
Because I want to use it in Wi-Fi situations.
Okay. Well, I personally use Gmail. I have a Yahoo account and a Gmail account, and I use my Gmail account most. So you can get a Google email account, that's what Gmail is, by going to gmail.com. And I think that's open enrollment now. Mm-hmm. There's no invites. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty good.
Yeah, okay. The other options are mail.yahoo.com or hotmail.com. I use Gmail as well.
Yeah. Okay. That's very useful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling, Heidi.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Now, the only thing about Gmail is that they do read your email. It's a sacrifice. It sounds evil, but it's the end result is it's the least annoying free email service provider.
Now, when you say they read your email,
I have Frank. Frank's reading my email.
Right.
They scan for keywords that they use for pushing advertising.
So it's an automated system that's looking for a certain type of.
Yeah. Instead of indexing web pages to do that search, they're indexing your mail archive.
It's funny, using Gmail to look at the questions for the geeks that we get through email. Mm-hmm. I get that in my Gmail, actually, and as I do all my mail. And the ads on the right are almost always like tech support people, you know, because, of course, the question's like, hey, why is my hard drive not working? And on the right-hand side, there's an ad that says, if you need to fix a hard drive, blah, 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 blah. So it's ads targeted to the content in your email message. Yeah. And I don't know if I'm assuming they're saving the indexing results, so there is some knowledge about what your dialogue is, but I wouldn't say there's any humans actually reading it. And there's a pretty good terms of service, and Google has that whole motto, we shall do no evil. But in any case, we still do use it.
Yeah.
All right. From Los Gatos, Lisa, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, you know, I just hung up on Lisa. Lisa, please call back. I'm so sorry. And from Santa Cruz, Rhonda, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi,
Rhonda.
I recently had my hard drive fail, and I have no backup for my data and photos, and I'm wondering if you can recommend the best approach to recover my data before my hard drive gets replaced.
Okay. Can you access the hard drive at all?
No.
Oh, and you have no backup.
Right.
Data recovery shop.
Mm-hmm. You can spend thousands of dollars to do a data recovery shop. There's a couple things you can do to try to get the data off yourself. First off, stop trying to use that. Are you on a Windows or a Mac?
Windows.
Okay. And do you have two hard drives on your computer or just one? Do you know?
One.
Okay. Got a good close geek friend that owes you a lot of favors?
No.
Do you cook or do anything else?
Right now I'm wanting one.
Yeah. Well, that's why you called us. All right. Who wants to go over to Rhonda's house? No, okay. So here's the deal, Rhonda. Did this drive? Did your system just stop booting? How do you know it's a hard drive failure?
I did tech support with the company that I bought the computer from, and the diagnostics proved a hard drive failure.
Did you like put a CD in the machine and stuff?
No, ran a like F12 when I was booting up, and it ran a diagnostic program.
Okay. All right. Okay, so the thing is your hard drive's not functional in some way. We know that because the diagnostic program and because your system's not working. But it's possible that the data is actually – some of it's still viable. Now, there's a likelihood that it's completely destroyed, like that the magnetic material that actually held your data has been ripped off the drive and has been pushed over into a little filter in your machine and is completely chaotic and the universe will never let it back because of the way – never mind. In any case what you could do is, you buy a new hard drive, and you take the hard drive that's currently in your machine, and you remove it from your hard drive, from your system. You put the new hard drive in, you install your operating system. That gets you a computer that's functional. Then you take the same hard drive that was bad, and there's going to be a little jumper on it, most likely. It depends on how old the drive is, if it's a SATA or if it's a parallel IDE. And go ahead and stop me when I've gotten too confusing. And then there's a little jumper on there that you want to set it to the slave setting and not the master setting. The new drive needs to be a master setting. And then you can plug in I'm going too far, aren't I?
No, actually, my brother told me to do that. There's a guy, tech, that's coming out from the company to replace the hard drive, and he said to have him set the old hard drive as the slave.
Yes, absolutely. Now, there's a couple things you want to do, though. When a hard drive is failing, the more you work it, the more you play with it, the more it's going to fail. So the thing that's most important to do is be very delicate with it and don't use it until you're ready to really try to get the data off. So after he plugs it in, I say, yeah, please plug it in. Tell me how to disable it. And he's probably going to suggest, well, you can just unplug this power cord from it. So what you're going to want to do is get your machine running and everything. Kind of it can be plugged in with the parallel port or serial ATA, but you have the power unplugged from it. And that way you can get your machine running. And everything after you got it running and everything, you want to go ahead and find a data recovery application. And I'd go ahead and spend up to $30 or $40 on one of these. Anybody have a suggestion of one they like? Data recovery on a Windows machine? No? We don't have a good solution? All right. You're going to do a Google on this, and the ads on the right are going to tell you which one to use.
Okay.
But basically, you're going to want to install a software application that will try to get the data off your drive. And then after you got the software installed, You want to turn off your machine, plug in the drive, boot your machine back up, and hope that you can get some of the data off.
Oh, I got one for you. Spinrite.
Spinrite?
Yeah. It's actually, you can download it. It's relatively cheap, under $50, I believe. It burns to a CD-ROM, and it boots its own environment, basically, with all the drivers it needs.
Here's the most important thing when data recovery is have a location that you can put your data as soon as you can, because you might only have one chance to access that data. And so you want to get it off the bad drive and put it on a good place as soon as possible. And that's why all the preparation of the new computers are a really good thing to do, because you're going to have a new installation. You're going to have a desktop you can copy your data onto. So the simplest one is not to install any software. You get your machine up and running. You put your old drive back into it as a slave. And then when it starts up, you can actually go with the Explorer and find the data on there and pull the most important things off. And do it in order of importance, and don't copy more than one thing off at a time.
Okay.
I think that's about as detailed as we get in an audio-only format.
Okay.
So, Rhonda, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And okay, so good. We got Lisa back from Los Gatos. Lisa, I'm so sorry I hung up on you. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Quite well. What's your question?
Well, I'm getting ready to buy a new laptop, and I'm trying to decide whether or not a WLAN is really an important thing for me to have. I'm a little confused.
You mean a wireless LAN, is what you're saying?
No, the wide area wireless network, the WLAN.
So it's like
Sprint or Verizon.
Oh, like a WiMAX or something like that.
Right. And, you know, I can't get anyone to really give me a straight answer about whether or not just having a WLAN is enough and whether I really do need the wide area wireless network. What do you guys think?
Okay, well, wide area wireless network, the basic idea is instead of running a cable like cable or a phone line like DSL to your house, you're going to receive your signal through a wide area LAN, whatever they're called. If you can get DSL, that's a preferred thing to get. Do you understand?
Well, I understand. You know, in my house, I have Comcast in my house. I already have an Apple Airport.
Oh, okay.
Functioning. It's like when I'm out on business and I'm away.
You're talking about like a card for your laptop to get wireless anywhere, ubiquitous wireless.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is like Sprint service.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And this is different than the WLAN that's in the computer. So do you think that it's really important for me to have it when I'm out in business to use an airport? I don't know whether or not it's enough just to have Wi-Fi.
Your laptop is going to access the Wi-Fi networks, so because it has a Wi-Fi card in it. So what you're talking about is getting a service, or are you talking about getting a laptop upgrade of some kind, like a card that would use like Sprint's
So right now the Dell has a 1330 that comes with the wide area wireless network card installed, and so does Sony. They have an SD that comes with it installed, but none of the Macs come with this installed. They don't even have it. They have Wi-Fi, but they don't have the wide area.
Yeah, you'd need an add-in card for the Macintosh to support that. You know, I think ultimately, Lisa, this is a personal preference thing. How easily accessible you want to have broadband internet. If you want to have it anywhere that there's going to be service for Sprint or whatever wide area coverage providers that they have, you are going to pay for it. You know, it's like, I think we're $50
like
a month.
Yeah, it's like getting another cell phone.
Yeah. I mean, so if you want, you know, maximum availability of the internet for you when you're about, you know, doing your business, you know, if you're in a hotel or something traveling and they don't have it, you know, you just turn it on and it works. I mean, if that's important to you, you know, I'd say go for it. Have that option in your laptop. I don't think it's going to cost that much more to have that piece of hardware in your laptop. It's going to limit, you know, what your options are for laptops to purchase.
Right.
So, you know, you need to also consider, you know, do you like the laptop that features available for? I mean, because you can always add it into a PC card slot.
Yeah. And Lisa, we can suggest how we do wireless anywhere kind of thing. I normally go to coffee shops. So in the areas where I'm away from my office or away from my home, I know the coffee shops in the area that offer free wireless, and I just spend time there when I need access. And the way our economy works, those are normally open when you need them. And in airports, I don't do a lot of flying anymore. Miles, what was your experience when you last traveled? Your last job had a lot of travel in it.
Yeah, there were times where I needed to have access, and so I paid the $10 to, use it for the 24 hours.
The Wi-Fi.
Yeah, for 24 hours, except that I was only going to be in the airport for two.
Yeah.
Right, but your WLAN basically gave you the access. You didn't need the wide area network, correct?
Well, so in the airport, there's actually Wi-Fi
hotspots
and hotspots, but you have to have a service plan with them to get access to it. So,
right.
In the airport, you don't really need the wide area network that's provided by the cell phone companies. You instead can use their Wi-Fi. You just have to pay for it. So the question is, outside the airport, on the street, is it important for you to have wireless or have network traffic there? And in that situation, you need something provided by a cell phone company.
Okay.
And then you come across, again, you're going to have a coverage issue. This is my understanding is this is going to be a metropolitan area feature.
Yeah.
You know, if you're out in, rural areas, you're probably not going to have the service anyway.
And I would, if anyone else is out there really with a lot of wireless access desires and they have a service like this from Sprint or something, give us a call because none of us do have the service. And let Lisa know and let everybody know how it works for you. You can give us a call at 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800 and gives you your opinion, or 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Thanks, Lisa. Hopefully someone with more experience with this kind of service will call in and give us their opinion.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you, Lisa. Bye-bye. We're going to go ahead and take a call from Boulder Creek. Fred, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning, geeks.
Good morning, Fred.
Hi, this is Fred up here in Boulder Creek. Hey, I'm thinking about Christmas already. We're going to maybe my wife and I are going to give each other an upgrade to our hard drive for Christmas.
Okay.
Because we do video editing, and with the new, the lower prices and the bigger sized hard drives, we're going to upgrade our old hard drives on our G5 computer.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like you can get hard drives as big as, 750 up to a terabyte now.
Yeah.
And they're pretty reasonable in price. But I'm wondering if you know whether there's a big difference in speed or any other quality issues between a 750 gigabyte drive and a terabyte if you're going to use it for like a capture scratch or video.
I think since you're on a G5, assuming you have your backup solutions totally taken care of, okay, you're going to be able to back this stuff up, or you know that it's on tape and you can always revert back to the tape.
Mm-hmm.
What I would recommend on a G5 is, and I'm not sure if your G5 has SATA connectors or parallel IDE connectors, assuming that it doesn't really matter because it's probably going to still have the same command of connectors. You can fit up to like four drives in your computer, and Apple has really great RAID support, which means you're going to stripe your data across multiple drives. You're going to get better performance, you're going to buy cheaper drives, you're going to have the same amount of data space. So, like, take 300 gig drives. So you take four 300 gig drives, that's going to be more than a terabyte of storage, and you're going to stripe it in RAID 0. So the data's across all the drives.
Whoa, RAID 0?
RAID 1?
No, RAID 1.
RAID 1. What's RAID 0?
RAID Copy. 0 is striping. RAID 1 is a mirroring.
No, I'm saying stripe it.
Yeah.
Striping it? Really?
Yeah, because assuming that he's got a backup solution, he wants speed and data storage. Stripe. Stripe is the same, the size of all the drives added up, and it's really fast.
But
if any of the drives die, he loses everything.
Yeah, I was going to get to that.
Okay.
Sorry.
But you have to have a really good backup solution to back up 2 terabytes of data.
Yes, yeah. You have to have a good backup solution. The thing is, with a 1 terabyte drive, you better have the same backup solution because it's the same thing. It's just that with a stripe situation, any of those drives fails, you lose all the data. And it's more likely to fail?
Yeah, I'm not too keen on the whole RAID 0.
How about RAID 5? Can Apple do a RAID 5?
No, not software. You have to buy a hardware device.
But RAID 1 is still pretty good. The write speeds.
Yeah, but RAID 1 is not going to give what he wants. He wants large storage.
That's true.
So he's going to buy two 500 gig drives to get 500 gigs of data. What you're doing with RAID 1 is you're doing a backup solution.
So
you're talking about internal drives, right, Fred?
The other option is not using a RAID. And if you don't use a RAID, first of all, you're not reliant on a software solution to get your data back if your computer itself fails. And the only disadvantage to that is that you have to manage what goes on the two hard drives. But that means if one of them dies, you only lose the stuff on that hard drive. You don't lose everything.
Right.
But if you concatenate, which is what RAID 0 does, then you lose one of the drives and you lose everything.
I granted. But okay, so one thing, Fred, is that if you buy a gigabyte drive, you're going to be spending top dollar for your storage.
Terabyte,
excuse me. If you buy a gigabyte drive, good luck. I don't know how to find one of those.
You know,
but a terabyte drive, you buy that, you're only spending the most amount of money you possibly can, almost, for that amount of storage.
Mm-hmm.
You buy two 500 gig drives, you're better off. They're probably going to be cheaper than the 1 terabyte. And you can do the thing where they're both independent and you can back them up or put your data on both of them, but you only lose one at a time.
Mm-hmm. Right now I only have slots, and I have an older G5, and I only have slots for two.
I think what you can do is up by the optical drive up at the top, you can put another drive there. So you can get three inside your case.
Ah.
I'd like to make is with the new 750 gig and terabyte drives, the performance just natively is a lot better than older drives. They're using the perpendicular storage technology and just
so
the advancements that they've made in the last year or so with these high capacity drives are way better than the older drives.
Yeah,
and
well,
I may not even have to worry about
so basically,
having to do that.
You're saying that my concern about the top dollar price. It's not a technical concern. It's just a financial.
Yeah. And are we getting ahead of ourselves? I mean, isn't it just worth giving the advice of just buy a 750 or a terabyte drive, put it in, and start using it?
Yeah, there's no difference between the two, the speed between a 750 and a terabyte?
The difference between brands is probably going to be bigger than the difference between sizes.
It's actually spindle speed is going to be the most thing. You want to look for a drive that has a 7200 revolutions.
There's a couple of websites out there that have done some recent benchmarks on it, Anantech.com and TomsHardware.com. Mm-hmm. I check those two out.
But, you know, getting a Seagate 750 gig drive, make sure it's a 7200 RPM, not a 54. 54 is slower. You don't want one of those. Get a
750, you say?
Yeah, 7200 RPMs is what you want. Get one of those drives, and it's going to be pretty fast.
Okay.
And then what you can do is you can keep running on your current drive as your operating system, or you can use this little application that Ben recently showed me, which is just fantastic, called
Super Duper.
Super Duper, which you put your other drive in, and then both drives will show up, and then you do a Super Duper copy of your current hard drive onto the new one, and you've moved your operating system. You unplug your old drive, and you can boot off your new one.
Can you really? Super Duper, is that it's
$50 though. It's not a freeware application. There's another one that you can use that's freeware. I'm pretty sure it's freeware. It's called Carbon Copy Cloner.
Uh-huh.
And that'll do a very similar thing. It'll copy everything over and it'll make your new drive bootable.
That's what I wanted to know.
And one other thing is right now Fry's has a sale of a 500 gigabyte drive for $100. And recently, also since it was just Black Friday, they had, I think, a 750 for $120, which is really, really good. They might be sold out of those. But now is definitely a good time to look because of the Black Friday sales.
Uh-huh. Fred, good luck, and drop me an email once you get your new hard drive in.
Well, thanks for the advice.
Thanks, Fred. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to take some more calls. I just want to remind everybody that in about 7 minutes, we're going to do Castle Cottage, and the Geeks are doing Castle Cottage this week. So call up your friends with kids and tell them to listen to KOSP in a few minutes. And we're going to do a lot of show tunes, I believe. My wife's going to be here with a whole bunch of songs with show tunes. So anybody that likes show tunes will love the Castle Cottage this week. And I think we're going to have a book review from my 6-year-old son, Wyatt, of a new cookbook he has. So a lot of interesting kid content, family content, coming up in about 10 minutes. We're going to take now a call on GeekSpeak from... Let's see. Yeah, Santa Cruz. Mike, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, Mike. What's your question today, sir?
I have an older PowerBook G4, and the disk drive is broken. Doesn't work.
The hard drive or the CD?
It's the CD.
Okay.
That's good, because you can still use your computer.
and also there's problems with like those flash memory cards.
Uh-huh.
There's problems reading those now. It doesn't actually read them.
Uh-oh. Because my next solution was to get a USB or FireWire optical drive. It's going to be the cheapest for you. And then you plug that in with a cable, and you can use that and not use the internal drive. Getting anything worked on a laptop is kind of expensive. Since you're in Santa Cruz, I'd recommend Dave's Computer? Dave's Computers. They're downtown Santa Cruz. And he can do service on laptops. I think it's a base level cost, like $100 to bring in a laptop to get it worked on. So it's going to be expensive. Now, what you can do is you can go up and buy a $40, and that's not going to be parts and stuff too, right? So you can go online and buy a $40 USB optical drive and plug that in and use that optical drive instead of the internal optical drive on your computer. We're talking about CD, DVD drive.
Right.
So if that works for you, it's a good thing. But if your USB sticks are not working, not mounting correctly, then it's a little troublesome. Maybe something's wrong with your USB.
You might need to go to FireWire.
You might need to go to FireWire. On
that. Yeah, the FireWire works because we downloaded some stuff off a friend's external hard drive. So
that's what I would suggest is go ahead and get an optical drive, FireWire optical drive. Might be a little more expensive. You can do this two ways. You can buy one that's complete unit, or you can buy an enclosure that's FireWire and an optical drive.
That's cheaper than trying to get the disk drive fixed.
Most likely, yeah.
Because you're going to spend, base level $100 plus the parts for the drive. Now, I would go to – I mean, it's not going to hurt you to go to Dave's Computers in Santa Cruz, since you're in Santa Cruz already, and go and just visit them or call them up on the phone and say, hey, I've got a G4. I've got a bad optical drive. How much will it cost for you to replace it? He might give you a rate that's reasonable, and that's more time and, less time and trouble for you versus going and finding an enclosure and an optical drive that will fit the enclosure. Yeah. One thing to note is almost all optical drives are still using parallel ATA connectors, and most of the new enclosures that you can connect with FireWire are using SATA connectors. So you want to be really careful to get an enclosure that uses parallel ATA. And if all of this is something that just scares you, go ahead and go to a shop like Dave's Computers and have them do it.
It's cool as long as I remember the key.
Yeah, so the key thing is optical drives are... I'm saying the key thing is optical drives almost always parallel ATA connector types and enclosures that support FireWire, any enclosures really. You want to get a 5.25-inch enclosure bay, and that'll hold your CD drive. And you want it to be FireWire. And if you've got, and then you also want to make sure that the enclosure supports parallel ATA inside the enclosure.
You think he needs to build one from an enclosure rather than purchase one that's already designed?
It'd probably be a little cheaper to buy them as two different things and put them together. But yeah, you could, of course, what Ryder's saying is just go up and find a FireWire optical drive and buy that. Because it'll
basically
already be an enclosure.
I'm just using it mostly for burning disks and or playing putting for software. But I mean that's okay, so basically he's probably better off trying to save up and get a new computer too, huh?
Yeah, if you really want to be simple, that's one way to go.
I understand.
If you do get a new Mac, a really easy way to transfer data is using what's called target mode. You can turn your whole laptop into an external FireWire drive. You turn off the machine. When you push the power button, you then push the T key and you hold the T key down, and then it becomes an external FireWire drive. You can plug in your new computer. But
is it still worth upgrading the memory at all, or in
a G4, you're going to have such an amazing performance boost getting any kind of Intel Mac that if you're thinking about upgrading a new machine, just get the lowest cost laptop new Mac, and it's going to be outperform your G4 like nobody's business. Thank you.
Oh, man.
Thank you so much for the call. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
This is Geek Speak. We're running out of time for calls today, as we do every week. Thank you so much for calling in with your questions and comments of technology. Oh, where's my sheet? Yeah, here we go. Okay. First off, I want to say that tune in for This American Life Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, one of my favorite shows that we air via, I believe it's NPR, but it might be PRI. Anyway, Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Ryder Brooks. Geeks, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
And thank you for listening to... Ben, what about you? You glad to be here?
Yeah.
Ryder?
Yeah, I guess.
Oh, man. What a bummer way to end. Well, I'm glad I'm here. And I guess you're glad you're here because you listen to Geek Speak again. We wasted another one of your hours. Thank you for calling in with questions and comments. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo. Streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. You just listened to another episode of Geek Speak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about Geek Speak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. Geek Speak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.